So clearly, the global economy's addiction to oil, which is really the kind of underlying theme in my book, I would argue that it's heading us into a lot of trouble. And yet, you know, this whole problem that it's creating on the geopolitical front, I would argue, is in many ways not the worst of it. Even more serious is sort of part two of the energy dilemma, and that is that our enormous consumption of oil, I mean, and other fossil fuels too, is leading us to a situation where we're compromising the very viability of the planet in the form of, you know, global warming. The scientific evidence against global warming is simply overwhelming. It's a little bit like the case against smoking. It's really open and shut. I mean, there's a UN process that's been set up to review the whole issue of the scientific evidence on global warming. And there's literally thousands of scientists around the world that have consulted with this committee. And they have found very conclusively that global warming is a real problem and that it, you know, is definitely influenced by human behavior, that it's something we are making worse by our extreme consumption of fossil fuels. And yet there's a small group of enormously powerful companies, basically the oil lobby, that are resisting what obviously has to be done. We have to move off our addiction to oil. But it's not particularly surprising that they would resist furiously the way they are, to the point that they have created this whole massive campaign to confuse the public into believing that the science of global warming is, you know, unclear, that it hasn't been established, when in fact it has been thoroughly established. But this isn't surprising, because these companies, of course, are in the business of selling oil. And so they don't want to suggest anything that's going to reduce our addiction to oil, any more than, a drug dealer would be keen to, see their client's drug habit rehabilitated. Now, the sad thing is, of course, this very small but powerful group of companies, in fact, probably the most powerful group of companies in the history of the world, led by Exxon, the biggest, most powerful oil company and company in general in the world, the oil companies have an extremely close relationship to government, particularly to the U.S. government, and particularly, of course, we know to the Bush administration, although not, it hasn't been exclusively to the Bush administration. This problem didn't begin with Bush. But with the Bush administration, it's taken on a whole new realm. I mean, Bush, again, one of the things he did very quickly after he took power was immediately withdraw the U.S. from Kyoto, the attempt to deal with the global warming problem, even though, the Bush administration knows full well how serious the global warming problem is. In fact, there was a Pentagon study that came out, well, it didn't come out. In fact, it was a secret study, but it leaked out last fall, and it just outlined just how potentially serious the global warming situation is. It talked about how in the next 20 years, Britain and parts of Europe could end up submerged underwater, and North America could be subject to extremes of heat, extremes of cold, there'd be mega droughts, mega floods around the world. I mean, the picture they paint is really quite horrific. And of course, the Pentagon doesn't care about the environment. What their concern is national security. Because their point is that in situations this dire, this is going to set off incredible global conflict. And they, at one point, they describe it as, they say, under this scenario, humanity would revert to a constant battle for diminishing resources. Warfare would once again define human life. You know, pretty serious stuff. But amazingly, when this document was leaked and appeared in the British press, and barely was picked up at all in the American press. I mean, maybe it had something to do with the fact that the week it came out was the you know, the, it was a lot of big news that week. You know, that was the week that it came out that Janet Jackson's breast had been exposed. You know, so the media was kind of busy that week. But you know, I don't want to leave you with the impression that I'm all negative on this. I want to quickly sort of talk about how solvable this problem is. I mean, the answer, of course, is to get off our addiction to oil, as everybody except the fossil fuel lobby pretty well can see that. And of course, alternative energies are enormously promising, wind and solar power. But you know, even before we get into that, just simply greater efficiency and conservation can make a huge difference. In fact, you know, if you go back to 1973 and that sort of energy crisis that we experienced, one of the fascinating things that happened there was that it was kind of a wake-up call, and very quickly governments responded and, in fact, brought in legislation, things like fuel economy requirements for cars, requirements that appliances be more efficient, and very quickly we managed in North America to reduce our energy consumption through a few measures like that by something like 30%. It was stunning. We'd hardly put any effort into it at all, and we were immediately able to reduce our energy dramatically. You know, and were we worse off as a result? Did we suffer because, you know, our cars were more energy efficient? Or, you know, do we feel worse because our refrigerators consume less energy? I mean, it's ludicrous. And yet, here's the tragic thing, you know, that, I mean, the really big breakthrough was with the fuel economy on cars. And what happened was that the governments in the United States, and we did copy this up in Canada, required that car manufacturers simply make cars more fuel efficient, and they, you know, had it all specified what the standard they had to meet. And it turned out before that there had been no attempt at fuel efficiency, so you could immediately make huge gains. But the problem was that after making those huge gains, then the government, you know, failed to follow up on that. There was no, after 1980, there was no further tightening of the fuel economy requirements. Now, you might think, well, okay, maybe the technology didn't improve at all, but the technology kept improving. This is the amazing thing. I mean, it wasn't that car manufacturers didn't get more and more efficient in the way they made their engines. They did. But because there was no requirement on the fuel economy side, they directed all those improvements in the efficiency of their engines into something else. They directed it instead into making ever bigger vehicles that could go ever faster, you know, ever greater propulsion. You know, talk about squandering the gains of technological advances. I talked to one mechanical engineer who said that, he said, you know, if we continue on the path we're on, what we're going to end up with is 18-wheelers that can accelerate like racing cars. You know, I mean, this is what we're doing with our technological advances. Now, finally, I want to say just a little bit about the subject of inequality. Because, you know, the whole issue of global warming, while it's, you know, catastrophic to the entire world, I would argue it's particularly unfair to the third world in the fact that, you know, we all suffer, but they didn't even get the energy consumption part of the deal. They just get the suffering part of the deal. You know, they didn't get the benefits of that energy consumption that led to all the greenhouse gas emissions. And yet they suffer equally. In fact, if anything, they'll probably end up suffering more because, of course, you don't know exactly how all these greenhouse gases go up there and they just form above the Earth and alter the Earth's weather patterns and climate patterns. You don't know exactly how it's going to play out, but the third world is, of course, probably less able to defend itself from whatever horrible climatic things may befall it. And in a sense, you know, it's interesting because we in the developed world consume by far the majority of the energy I mean, that's why we've had this sort of, you know, luxurious lifestyle. You know, here in the U.S. and Canada, we consume on average about 70 times what a typical person consumes in Bangladesh. And so we're responsible for the global warming problem that's happened up to date. Now, in the future, the developing world may become a problem, but up to now, the global warming that's happened up till now is almost entirely the work of the developed world. And so that's what Kyoto attempted to reflect. The Kyoto Accord, in trying to address this problem, it put the burden on the advanced world, because the advanced world is the one that's done all the energy consuming. So in the first round of Kyoto, it's the advanced part of the world that has to bear the burden, and the less developed part of the world is going to be brought on in future negotiations. But this fact that the advanced world was to bear the burden, which is only fair in any meaningful sense of the world, since it's our problem, this was used by right-wing forces in the U.S. to argue against Kyoto. This was the key argument, in fact, that it was the third world ganging up on America again, you know, and that was the reason. There was ads run down there where they showed a map of the world and they would cut out, you know, third world countries and say, you know, these countries don't have to contribute to reducing greenhouse gases. You know, so there's this whole sort of vilification of the third world. But I would argue that this whole global warming thing is just then going to compound the already grotesque level of inequality that we have in the world. And, you know, sadly, you know, if there was ever a willingness to even consider the issue of global inequality, that moment really seems to have passed. You know, after 9/11, the whole issue of global inequality just seems to have been pushed right off the international stage. The neoconservatives in the U.S., of course, have seized the mantle of 9/11 to insist on the kind of moral rightness of America, the sort of moral superiority of the American way of life, which, of course, includes this voracious appetite for energy, which is sort of held to be non-negotiable. So there's virtually no challenge or little challenge going on today to the kind of global piggery that the West is indulging itself in. And I guess I, you know, just was struck by an interview I saw on TV just before the invasion of Iraq began, and they were interviewing sort of people on the street in Baghdad, and one man said, just in exasperation, said, "Must the Americans eat every meal? Must they drink every drink?" And that strikes me as a very good question. Anyway, that's all I was going to say, but I'm certainly happy to take any questions or respond to any comments or whatever. So we'll just sort of throw it open to the floor at this point. Thank you. Thank you.